does our life as Episcopalians, as well as our liturgical expressions of worship, form and invite us to live lives of justice and reconciliation and peacemaking?
So is it, it's too snarky to say, how do they not, right?
Yeah. Good evening and welcome to Theology Live, a podcast and live event that highlights the playful dance between theology and contemporary life. Our guest this evening is the Reverend Winnie Varghese. Winnie currently serves as the priest for justice and reconciliation at Trinity Church Wall Street in New York City. Winnie is the author of Church Meets World, editor of What We Shall Become, a regular contributor for the Huffington Post, and is a leading voice in the Episcopal Church, particularly around issues of social justice. I'm Meredith Day, Minister of Youth and faculty member at Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church and School, and this is Theology Live. Winnie, it's so good to be with you this evening.
Oh, so great to be here.
Yes, I'm so glad to have you and so grateful to you and also to Calvary for facilitating this time together tonight. So this is a time just for us to get to know you better. And as we begin our time together, I wonder if you will start by sharing a little bit more about your own spiritual background, your own spiritual history, and kind of the path that has led you to this current place in priesthood.
So my friends that are lawyers tell me that I do this wrong. I don't know how to tell the story in a linear way. But I try to make it more and more linear each time, so I'm going to try. I'm from Texas. Everywhere I go, someone else in the room is from Texas. You're from Texas. I was born in Dallas, Texas. My parents are both immigrants from India. And when I was born in Dallas, my dad was a student at the University of Texas in Arlington. And they thought they were going to go back to India when he finished. And that was the plan in 1970. I was born in 1972. So I was born in Dallas and was sent to India about a year later. My dad took me. I wasn't sent in the mail. I went with my dad. My mom stayed. Immigration even then was really complicated. She was working as a nurse, and if she had left, she probably wouldn't have been able to come back on the visa she had. And I lived there for a couple of years. So I was born in the U.S. I'm a U.S. citizen, but English is not my first language. I remember learning English. And I remember learning English in kindergarten. I remember the teacher in the Episcopal school that I went to telling my parents, the principal, I think it was even a Montessori school, it's really progressive Episcopal space, telling my parents that if I didn't speak English well, I couldn't come to kindergarten. I wasn't qualified for kindergarten. And so the way to do that was to make sure that they only spoke English to me. And I remember saying it. It's one of my first memories of the United States after I'm going to the dentist and having a tooth removed. And I think what my parents said is, so they stopped speaking Malayalam to me. They only spoke English. So part of my own spiritual journey is in my life, I've had these dreams that are silent. And I was pretty old before I realized they were actually memories that I had even told my brain not to speak Malayalam to me in my dreams. So part of my story is reclaiming the story of where I come from, where my family comes from, and frankly, not from a sense of profound loss. We are enormously privileged. My mother came here having already, as a nurse, my father was coming to university. We had relatives here. When they needed financial help, they could write to England for that. I mean, we were fine. But part of my story was trying to figure out who I was. In a really, coming from a pretty wonderful and nurturing environment in Dallas, I went to SMU. And that story is that my family is from a community in Southwest India in Kerala that are the, it's called the Thomas community. They are people that would say, our story is that Thomas came to Kerala in the first century, and we'll dare you to prove he didn't. And he converted some families, and there's a lot of stories about who those families were. None of that can actually be proven, I would say. But they were converted, and we are the community descended of those people. And in the 5th century, the Syrian church went east in a missionary endeavor that was very successful. You can find Syrian crosses in archaeological digs all the way into China. You can find them in Korea. So the Syrian Orthodox Church goes east, and we were part of that movement. So we are, my mother is part of the Syrian Orthodox Church in India called Jacobite, and that is the church that I feel the most connected to by in terms of heritage. My father is from one reform removed from that because it wouldn't be church if we didn't break off from each other. And that's the church I was baptized into. And they brought the bishop from India because there were five or six of us that had been born in the U.S., and the bishop came on a tour and baptized all of us. We learned in our 30s when we realized on Facebook that all of our baptismal certificates were one or two days off from each other all over the United States by the same guy. Wow. So my spiritual heritage is the Orthodox Church, and I am claimed by it. I claim it. But I grew up in Dallas with Episcopalians and Methodists and Orthodox people and the Church of South India.
Wonderful. That's great. And tell us more about your journey to the priesthood. What led you to this vocation?
Yeah, it was pretty improbable, frankly. I went away to college because I was really interested in international development, which I think was, frankly, was about wanting to know more about myself and where we came from. So my parents had both worked in different ways in that kind of work right after when they were very young adults in India, and they told stories about it. So I went off to college to do an international relations degree to figure out how to get a job with the UN or something like that and do some good in the world, and I think have some access to places that seemed very far away from Dallas, Texas. And in my first year of school, I had to take a class, a required Bible and religion class, and I didn't want to take it. I thought it was a really archaic thing to require in 1994, or whatever year it was, 1993, and I couldn't get out of it. And so I took Women in the Hebrew Scripture. I could have taken World Religion, but I took Women in the Hebrew Scripture with Tina Pippin, an Episcopal deacon in Atlanta. I had no idea what any of those things meant at the time. And she just blew open the text for me. I had no idea you could read the Bible that way. I had no idea that's what was hidden in the readings I had heard every weekend my whole life. And the thought I had was, I gotta be a priest. I'm gonna be a priest. I have to be about this. And my second thought was, are women priests? I'd never heard of that. Like, was that a thing? And then I thought, well, I could teach religion. That's what Tina's doing. And then maybe when I was 40 or some kind of old, wise age, I could think about the priest thing again. That was literally, those were the thoughts I had in order. And I told the chaplain, our chaplain was Presbyterian. I told her my whole illogical thing, including, can women be priests? She's a Presbyterian woman, pastor. And she's like, yeah, there are some. You can do that. And made it seem like she didn't think it was an unusual thing to think. And I have been so fortunate along the way, because there's so many things about me that make me an improbable candidate, especially in the early 90s in the Episcopal Church. And all along the way, including with priests that didn't believe that women should be ordained, they would point me to someone else who would be supportive. And I was really lucky, and I was ordained in Los Angeles.
Wonderful. Well, let's talk about more about this role as priest that you hold at Trinity Church, Wall Street. So you are the priest for justice and reconciliation. And I wonder, I get the justice part some, but I hope you'll open up for us some too about reconciliation. What is reconciliation, and how can we best understand it as it pertains to a communal and vocational identity?
Trinity is interesting, right? We have such enormous resource, and we know that, right? The institution knows that it is blessed and lucky. And so even in my title, it's happened to many of us there, trying to find the right way to describe what we're trying to do is tricky. So we started with community outreach. We were looking for something else because that really wasn't it. And we picked justice and reconciliation because they're both biblical terms. They're in the Bible. That seemed like a good way to go. And it's an enormous title. I mean, there's no way that we hit all of what should be hit in that. But the scope of the work I get to do includes our domestic grants program, which is, it's millions of dollars a year that get to, and in my opinion, should be moved towards social change. The church needs to reclaim its voice in the public square and align itself with the restoration of our society. So the focus right now is, the lens is racial equity, but the focus is the criminal justice system. And to have a church stand firmly on the side of eliminating certain kinds of penalties in the city, closing Rikers Island is one of the things that we're a part of, but also just substantive bail reform and making the connections between the legacy of slavery in this country and what our mass incarceration system looks like, and then putting real money behind it. So I keep walking into meetings feeling like we're pretty new. Trinity hasn't been doing this for a long time. I'll sit in the back of the room, happy to listen. And people will invite us up to the front, and they want us there because they're so intrigued that a church is there and that Trinity is, which I think understood as part of the establishment, as the Episcopal Church is there and gets it and wants to be supportive. So part of that for me is reconciling us to our mission in the world, which is work for us. But there's this huge grant side, and then there's all the direct program that we get to do in the city. of New York, which is, it's not as much as we want to be doing. We'll do more. And the reconciliation piece is, and I know people disagree with me on this, including in where I work, but I think Christians, I don't think we have a choice not to look at relationship and the restoration of relationship. So I don't think we have to, we can do that on the backs of people. You know, I don't think we say, I'm going to subjugate you, but you've got to be nice to me and see my humanity. But I don't think we also get to say, we're creating justice in the world and we'll leave it at that. You have a good time over there. I think we are compelled by relationship. And reconciliation for me is about that piece. And so we've got to be careful not to do it selfishly. It is about the restoration of our own souls.
Right. And Trinity is, I've been to Trinity and it's a beautiful space and has so much history. It's 300 years old, is that right?
I think 321 or something, yeah.
321 years old with, you know, former congregants such as President George Washington,
Alexander Hamilton.
Like, this is a place that is so, as you said, well-resourced and just an incredibly wealthy and powerful parish. And meanwhile, it sits within an already very wealthy and powerful denomination of the Episcopal Church. And so I'm wondering just how does the identity of Trinity in particular, as well as the identity of the Episcopal Church, both serve as a challenge as well as an aid to your work in justice and reconciliation?
So one of the things I found interesting coming to Trinity is I've been a priest for 18 years, and it was hard. It was kind of hard in my heart to imagine having to claim that I worked at Trinity Wall Street. And I confess it, because I think it's my own vanity about frankly, being in these kind of righteous places in the church. I was a college chaplain. That is righteous because we don't treat our young people well in our church. I was at St. Mark's in the Bowery. It had been struggling for so long that it was righteous to go and be there, and they're kind of vigilant, justice-oriented places. And it was my own, you know, those are my commitments and my values, but also there's a little bit of, for me, some immaturity in that I was always the good guy. You know, and if people didn't like what we did, you had to admit that it was just, it was good. Trinity doesn't get to be the good guy in that way. We don't deserve it. You should look critically at us. People do. I found that to be a harder identity point to start with, and it has Wall Street at the end of its name because it's on the end of Wall Street, you know, and there are billions of dollars that are in funds that create resources that that we spend. I mean, there are numbers that don't make sense to me. All those things are very hard. I think what's interesting about Trinity for me is not the journey I would have expected, is because it is absolutely tied to the founding of this country. You know, Washington takes the first oath of office at the Federal Building on Wall Street and then walks up Broadway to St. Paul's with what was at the time the entire government of this venture called the United States, and they pray together. These are slave owners and adventurers, and I mean, all, you know, the complex mess of who we were, and so many people not represented. You know, there were no women in that room, there were no black people in that room, no native people in that room probably. Really complicated and also critical and foundational. This is a place that gets to tell the story of who we will be. It comes with responsibility that nowhere else I've been bears in quite that way. What's been interesting about actually being at Trinity is I haven't found that my job is hard, that I've got to convince the staff of 200 or the congregation that we should be on the side of justice. I find an entire institution begging to be on the side of justice, ready to do it, wondering how to do it, and ready, just ready. Like how, if anything, the feedback I get is, why aren't we doing more? Like, really, is that all we could do? And I have to say, for all the righteousness of everywhere else I've worked, I have always taken a lot of pushback. It's always been hard to get to the point of doing something kind of bold, like saying, you know, we're going to be part of the campaign to close Rikers Island. That would be a long conversation in any other church I've been a part of, and we might or might not get to do something. At Trinity, it was, all right, how do we do that? I think historically, it's been very quiet about the good that it's done, because it's aware of the great privilege institutionally that it occupies, that it has. But I think in this day and age, it's actually really important for us to be very public about what our values are, because they also, I think, we speak to the entire Episcopal Church, as well as the City of New York.
I'm Meredith Day, and this is Theology Live. This evening, I'm with author and Episcopal priest, the Reverend Winnie Varghese. We are discussing the work of justice and reconciliation as it relates to your home parish at Trinity Church Wall Street in New York City, as well as the larger Episcopal community. So, Winnie, let's go deeper, too, talking about the Episcopal Church in particular. How does our life as Episcopalians, as well as our liturgical expressions of worship, how do they inform and invite us to live lives of justice and reconciliation and peacemaking?
So is it, it's too snarky to say, how do they not, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
No, you can say it.
Yeah. You know, I think one of, there's so many gifts in, I'm sure in every tradition, but in ours. And one of the reasons, as a person who comes from an Orthodox tradition, that I find, I think many of us that come from that tradition find this church so comfortable, frankly, is it feels to me often like the Orthodox Church in English, that our sacramental tradition points to a sanctity in human living, to a divinity in our living, to a call so far beyond what we might think just basic survival is in the world. I mean, for Orthodox people, I think for all sacramental people, we live in two realities at the same time, right? We're living in, here you are in Lent, right? You guys are really in Lent here. You guys do Lent maybe bigger than anywhere I've ever been, right? I mean, that's a parallel reality to the rest of your day. You know, even if you have integrated that well, most of the people that you talk to that aren't in this building aren't living that reality or living it differently than yours. So we're living this other life all the time. It's like the best description I've seen is that it's as though a whole other universe hovers above us and we're skipping back and forth between them and trying to integrate them. And so the sacramental life, I think, invites us into a whole other worldview that is much more radical than the world permits. You know, I would say that's true in India, it's true where my parents are from and those political realities, and it's true here. The world will tell us what's possible, and we know what's possible. We're practical people, right? God tells us something really different. And the sacramental life means that we're not reliant on the week that the clergy have had, right? On all these things that come of this place, of the world that we live in, to be reminded of the world that should be, that we live in light of that all the time, and of ourselves, right? Who we should be. I think if anything, if there's a danger in it, and I'd say the same for the Orthodox in the sacramental life, is that it can become, and our culture has become this too, and actually Billy Graham's death reminds us of the culture wars, it can become totally personalized. Right, that it's about your own piety or it's about the control of certain people's bodies. It's really small. And actually, you know, there's nothing about Jesus that's small. You know, the Bible isn't small. It's not kind of in our brains or, you know, it is actually about a worldview, right? It's about making a world. And I think at our best, that comes to us all the time. And it comes into us all the time. And I'm not going to say about our worst because I would like us to be at our best.
Yeah, that's true. All right. So again, at Trinity, I'm mindful, and we've mentioned just our friendship, our mutual friend of Beth Blunt. Yes. And up at Trinity, they do so much wonderful work, and they also certainly value music and the arts in a similar way as does this congregation of Calvary and where I come from, Grace St. Luke's. So I wonder if you would go with us for a moment and talk about what does the role of imagination and beauty play in the work of justice making?
So one, I think the Episcopal Church, and I guess it's probably true that the church overall in the United States is one of the great preservers of culture, right? In some ways, I've heard some English friends say we preserve English culture better than they do, you know, that we have a preservation component, for better or for worse. And I think we have also just a great love of beauty. And I actually think that is, I mean, other people like beautiful things, but we might be one of the few traditions that claim it. Like, we don't have a lot of shame about that. We're pretty proud of it. And so for those of us that come from the tradition, we might be surprised to find it called that. But from those that come to the tradition, it is often what people say is one of the reasons people come to this tradition, is the beauty of the liturgy, our appreciation of beauty and the arts. And so for me, I think it's Lucy Winkett. I know it's actually Lucy Winkett in London, who they did a really, I'm sure, extremely challenging but stunning. It's a church in the middle of Piccadilly Circus, very busy and wealthy part of London, a big shopping district. And I want to say in 2009, but it could have been 10 or 11, pretty early into my time at St. Mark's. Right around Christmas one year, I looked on my phone and social media, and there was this church I'd never heard of, St. James Piccadilly, and a wall in front of it. And it was a recreation of a portion of the Bethlehem wall, the wall in Bethlehem that I just drove through a couple of weeks ago with colleagues, that separates Bethlehem from Jerusalem, which is a walk. It's really close. And it's pretty hideous. It looks like a wall. If we had a wall on our southern border, it would look like that. And it's got graffiti on it, and it's pretty despairing. And they put it in front of their building. And she's a classically trained musician and singer, and they created all of this art and poetry around it. And they didn't take a position on it. They just put up the wall. But there it was in the middle of Piccadilly Circus, right? And it's pretty ugly, I thought. And then all these folks commenting and participating. And so as you can imagine, she took a lot of, there was a lot of feedback, right, in every forum that you can imagine. So I wrote to say, thank you. That it definitely gave my church a way to imagine how to use our space in the public square, because we're a public like that, and how to provoke conversation, maybe different conversation, and how to raise up voices that wouldn't be raised up otherwise. But she actually talked about the play between beauty and justice making, and then she insisted on only talking about that. She wouldn't say anything else about why that was there, and the place of art in opening up our imaginations and maybe kind of coming something entering our capacity to imagine in a different way than words might. And I'm a believer. So we had a couple of years later at Trinity, when I was at Trinity, we did a refugee tent, and it was an art installation by an artist, Issam Kurbaj, who's a lecturer in Cambridge. He's Syrian. And it was called Another Day Lost. And he said as the conflict began, and he's so far away from his family in Cambridge, and he's not religious, that he started to just light a match every evening and watch it go out as the war continued. And so he created an exhibit of those matches laid out. It was like 1,700 days by the time that exhibit came to Trinity, and little boxes made of waste paper that he collected that were the layout of the refugee camps that were forming right outside of Syria. And these matches just went around it like a big fence, and it was such a simple idea. And it was under just this kind of shabby tent in the courtyard at Trinity. And it just, you know, that in the shadow of Trinity Church, and then as you stick back further, which I had not figured out because I had just come to Trinity, the shadow of the new World Trade Center building told the story so clearly, you know, and in such a humane and human way, something so impossible to think about, right? And so I have those are two visual art examples, but yes, I'd say. And sometimes the things that are quite beautiful aren't technically maybe that beautiful.
Thank you. In your book, Church Meets World, you write this in the conclusion. In the 21st century, we Episcopalians have work to do. First, we have to understand sin as an active force in the world around us, one over which we have very limited, if any, power. From there, we can recognize our desperate need for God. I read that this week, and I was thinking about this time together in this season of Lent, where we as a church formally recognize this desperate need for God. And I'm wondering, just as we leave here today, how might we better understand kind of some of these ideas we've talked about justice and reconciliation for ourselves as well as our country and our communities during this particular moment, during Lent and the season and the life of the church?
Well, the thing that strikes me every year at Lent, right, is the idea of turning, you know, which is different than trying to scrub a sin out of your body, you know, which is how so many Christians talk about it, or have it to be covered or disappeared. You know, I find it not helpful, frankly. But turning is different, right? And that's the language that we use, that we turn, that in repentance and in forgiveness we turn. And we stand as people forgiven. But if we're turning, you know, if we look at this moment I think guns are the great example. But let's say guns and race are our big examples, but you could also do gender, I think, in this moment, sexual orientation, but definitely gender. That turning is actually possible. It doesn't mean that sin disappears. It doesn't mean it's not there. It doesn't mean that it's not a force. And I'm an old liberationist. I think sin is an overwhelming force. But not that I'm not an evangelical, and that I don't believe we are personally all worn down by it. I don't believe all of you are fundamentally so evil you can't get through the day being a decent human being. I don't believe it. I just don't believe it. I do believe that we are trapped in forces so much greater than we are and complicit in sin all the time, the big systemic sins of our time, that it might seem impossible to shift them, but our work is to turn, right? We reject over and over and we turn, and we know that we're gonna return and turn again. And so for some of us, that is personal, right? They're personal things that are our struggles that we keep turning. But I think as a society, you know, I frankly still find it unfathomable, and I grew up in Texas, that we have mass shootings in schools and we can't have a decent conversation about the one thing that makes that actually possible. Like, why wouldn't we say we would give up everything for our children, everything we care the most about if it would protect our children? And we know that we won't do that because Marion Wright Edelman, when she created the Children's Defense Fund, said the logic of caring for poor kids, poor black kids in rural America, was to just say children. They're children. Wouldn't we love them? But we see where that is. For poor kids in general, right? Education, nutrition, care of people. We have plenty of resource as a nation to take care of. And so in that way, I think we drown in these systems, and we are asked to turn, to keep pivoting, and to work in our time. And then we'll find ourselves dragged back, all of us. And some of you are so righteous that you won't, and you'll be barreling that way, and I'll come with you. But most of us, I find myself pivoting and turning back, and I need to keep turning. And we have a lot of turning to do. But I believe the hope of our tradition is that we can do that. It's not just something that we imagine and we don't attain. We can be very different as a society than we are. But a lot of us would have to stand up and actually stand up to what we call in our tradition sin. And that's tough. I think it's painful. It's why we say we need God. If we could do it, we wouldn't need God. Our tradition doesn't say both that there's brokenness and you got it. You know, our tradition says there's brokenness and it is so far beyond us and it's worth the work of your life.
Wow. Thank you. That's truly beautiful. Please join me in thanking Winnie for her presence with us here tonight. In the Episcopal tradition, the Ash Wednesday liturgy begins with an unusual invitation. The celebrant invites all who are present to the observance of a holy Lent, marked by a posture of penitence and fasting. After a few days, we might suddenly come to a buzzkill realization that we have been suckered into a pretty bland party, and that now we must recalibrate our expectations of the weeks to come and settle instead into a new season without the sympathies of sweets or spirits or social media. However, beyond the sometimes superficial deprivations associated with Lent comes a deeper call. In this same liturgy, the priest reminds us that these 40 days were also a time when those who had been separated from the body of the faithful were restored to the fellowship of the church. Through their self-examination, they came to terms with the truth of their humanity and their desperate need for the grace of God. In this Lenten time, as we seek to do the work of justice, may we also be mindful of the ways in which we remain estranged. And even in this wilderness, may this moment serve as a balm to our often aching hearts as we participate in the work of reconciliation to our communities, to God, and to ourselves. Theology Live is a ministry of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, a welcoming community of faith in the heart of Midtown Memphis. This episode of Theology Live was engineered and edited by Mr. Noah Glenn, who also composed our theme music. We offer special thanks to our hospitality coordinators, Ms. Kathleen Hansen and Ms. Nikki Glenn, our visual artist, Mr. Josh Colfer, and Ms. Debbie Balling and the entire staff of Calvary Episcopal Church for hosting us during their annual Lenten preaching series. Of course, we also offer much gratitude to our guest this evening, the Reverend Winnie Varghese. Join us back here again on Wednesday, March 14th in downtown Memphis at Calvary Episcopal Church for another iteration of Lent After Dark. I'll be sitting down with the Reverend Becca Stevens, author, Episcopal priest, and founder of Thistle Farms, located in Nashville, Tennessee. Visit us at 901theology.com and follow us on Twitter at 901theology or on Instagram at Theology Live for updates about our episodes and events. If you're not already, subscribe to Theology Live on your preferred podcast platform and then help enhance our digital visibility by reviewing us on iTunes. Thanks for listening.